The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier and Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Hello and welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show Q&A edition for this week. Thanks a lot for joining us today. I've got Jim joining me. He's already let me know. We've got a typical Social Security question to start the show off and then a mixed bag of stuff as we move forward. Hope you're all having a happy December when this show releases, December of 2022. That's when we're recording it as well. So I'll bring Jim in right now, just because I know he's got some limited time, so we want to dive into questions as soon as possible, although he might have some sort of holiday deviation to start the show with. He's promised us to make December fun on the show. Not that I thought the shows were always kind of fun, but extra fun or a little lighthearted in December here to kind of close out the year of 2022. So, Jim, what do you have for us today?
Well, you got all sorts of pressure on me now. I didn't have anything fun for today.
Okay. Well, maybe next Tuesday on the EDU show.
I will say I have improved our little game show.
For next time?
Yes.
Okay.
And I'm not sure if the game show should be called, huh? Meaning what? Just simple, huh? Which is what I usually say when Microsoft types some of the stuff I'm dictating in. I'm usually just saying, huh? But there could be, huh? Or what did Jim try to say? What do you think is the better name for the game show?
I think the huh gets the job done. And I like how short and sweet it is.
So. Well, that's me. Pithy, to the point, doesn't go on and on. Yeah. Direct. So, okay. So the name of the game show is, huh? And Bob has no idea. Does Bob listen to this? Because I might have just gave it away. I think he's been busy.
And even when he's not, I'm not sure he listens. So, this will come as a complete surprise to him.
This is going to be a complete and total surprise to him. But I've improved it dramatically. There's scoring. You can score 7 points, 3 points, or 2 points. It's modeled a little after football scoring. Okay. But it's going to be much better, because you and Greg just totally blew it last time.
No, it was a little messy last time.
You learn by doing, as you know. So anyways, folks, we'll have lighthearted fun next week on our December series of shows. Another thing that, folks, I want everyone to know, because I truly want people who have AFib to take it seriously. I've shared openly with everyone what's happened to me, how it's impacted me from a financial planning standpoint, retirement planning standpoint, getting insurance standpoint, whether that insurance is life insurance or LTC. Longtime listeners know what I'm talking about. The stroke I suffered, the AFib diagnosis that I have. If you know people with AFib, please tell them to take it seriously. It is a very, very dangerous and deadly condition. And the point is, and I've already shared this with Chris, and Chris's first reaction was, man, they're not giving you much time to think this through. I will have my second heart procedure on January 4th. So not too far into the new year. And so anyways, I'm freaking out over that again, as I did the first time. And I know, Chris, what the procedure entails, because I've already done it already, the ablation. Mm-hmm. It's just knowing. It's the anticipation. I think the anticipation is worse than what you actually go through. Because honestly, folks, you get to the hospital an hour and a half before my procedure is scheduled to begin. And they start poking you and prodding you and asking you all these questions and sticking needles in you and all this other stuff. And as soon as that little white mask thing goes over your face in the operating room, that's it. You're done. You don't remember anything from that point on until you wake up.
Hopefully. Well, just think of it as some of the best sleep you'll have all week.
But I really feel, folks, it's the anticipation. I don't want to do it. I will level with everybody. I don't want to go through it, but I will because my AFib, unfortunately, has been coming back with some regularity, and the doctor is not pleased, and neither am I, of course. But do tell people who have AFib. And I read as I was researching AFib, Chris, over the past couple of years, it's estimated that 30% of Americans have AFib. That's quite a bit.
Yeah. So and I think most, as I'm sure that study was pointing out, most people don't realize it, don't get checked. And hopefully that's because it's not so bad that it's causing a lot of issues. But a lot of times, as you saw there, I think they're attributing your stroke to AFib as the triggering cause there. You don't know until something major happens.
You don't. And at first, I was just always told by the doctors it must be anxiety. I first started showing signs of AFib, folks, and I would share to my doctor the symptoms, which I described to him, Chris, as the feeling I had as a young boy in grammar school or high school waiting to get the report cards. I don't even know if they do report cards anymore nowadays. But back then, you had that report card you had to bring home. The parents signed it. And that rapid heart rate of nervousness. Yeah. And I remember my doctor saying to me, well, what's going on in your life right now, Jim? And it was right when I bought Chris the office that you're in. I'm at home today as we record this. And I went into a lot of debt on the purchase of that office. And I expanded it in size, as you know, from 1,000 square feet to nearly 3,000 square feet. And it was reliant on paying the debt by having renters at the time. Anyways, all that was going on, and he diagnosed me with anxiety. Oh, you have anxiety with all the debt you're going into and the big business move you're doing. It's anxiety. I would encourage people, if you're attributing things to just anxiety, I think you're being too narrow focused. Try to look a little broader, which I wish the doctor did. And also what they would have had to have done is put a hot monitor on me for those 2-week monitors that I wear every now and then now. Mm-hmm. Which would have picked up that, oh, no, Jim doesn't have anxiety. Maybe he has anxiety, but he also has an irregular heartbeat called AFib.
Well, the nice thing on a modern, iWatch or my Galaxy Watch, my Samsung Galaxy Watch will pick up AFib as well. So there's at least better monitoring tools that people can check on themselves a little bit, monitor their own situation maybe. Isn't a good substitute for a doctor, but just another tool out there to maybe check on yourself if you have those weird feelings.
True. If I had that back then, which they didn't even exist back then, perhaps I would have had one of those watches. I can't say for certain. And perhaps I would have picked up on a certain time when I had that feeling that, wow, this is something called AFib. But anyways, folks, I just wanted to share with everybody, because I do. I'm, again, trying to help people and get our listeners to understand as well. And we'll chat about this on a couple of future shows, but we've had permission from one of our clients to share their story where they are no longer eligible to get insurance either because of procrastination. So we'll talk about this and get people to understand that. But, as we age, our bodies change, and we may think in our minds that we're healthy. Remember that one doctor who wrote to me after the AFib and the stroke story? And how did he word it? Oh, goodness. He said, you may be fit, but you're not healthy. something like that. And he wanted
to... because he kept talking about how you walk all the time. And
hike and
there's
hunt
some of those issues that really have nothing to do with your fitness, your level of fitness. I mean, there's people that have various diseases that it's just a luck of the draw, genetics, whatever it might be. And you're not going to work that away through exercise. It's there no matter what.
Exactly. And that's what he wanted to point out, folks, that a lot of my rationalization also, and maybe the reasons why I didn't push more when I kept complaining about this weird fluttering feeling, was I kept thinking, well, I'm in shape, I'm fit, I got nothing wrong with me. I hike 12 miles here and do this and do that. And he said, don't confuse being fit with being healthy. So I would pass those words again on from that physician. I have no idea who he is. He was just a physician who listens to the show. And I just thought that was an excellent, excellent way of putting it. And I want to hopefully help some people out there who, if you're feeling at ever that you get this weird beating going on in your heart and you just say, oh, wow, I must be getting nervous over this that's happening or that that's happening. Or you try to rationalize it away as if it's nothing. Just wishing it was nothing would make it nothing. I wouldn't do that, especially if it's AFib, because you throw a blood clot like I did from your heart into your brain, it can kill you. It didn't kill me, and the doctor told me point blank it should have. It was a very serious stroke, and no one can believe I've recovered. So I want to take this opportunity that I've been given and try to get people to take AFib seriously and take any type of weird beating in your heart seriously. Especially, Chris, the way you point out now, just get one of those. I think even that $200 Fitbit now tells you if you have AFib or an irregular heartbeat. So it's not like these little gizmos you wear on your wrist are expensive. Just buy one, put it on. And next time you get that feeling, try to self-diagnose, if you will, and then go see a doctor if it throws a warning out. That's it. I don't want to go too deep down there, Chris, but I did tell people I would share with them when I'm going to go under the knife.
January 4th.
They're not giving me any time to...
That's okay. Just rip that Band-Aid off, get it over with.
Yeah. Easy for you to say.
The longer you wait, the longer you have to worry about it, so...
And it is. It's. I said this last time, and I'll say it again. It's the anticipation. I think that is the worst freaking thing. Yeah. All right. Okay. Anyways, as we normally do, we lead with a Social Security question. This is a normal Q&A show, mm-hmm. So it's just going to be
as normal as they can be. Nothing about this show is normal.
True.
Just throwing it out there.
And then the rest of the show is just going to be a potpourri, or as Microsoft would say, Chris... Call Petty.
Okay, yeah.
I'll call Paris, but right. I think it meant call Petty of different questions. Okay, so it came in August 17th, and mm-hmm. the listener is in, the fine state of Kentucky. Oh. So, yeah, might be my home state someday, folks, or Ohio, one of the two. Okay, it says, hi, Jim and Chris, Social Security question. Love the show. It's my favorite podcast. Well, thank you, listener. We appreciate that. I have a question regarding spousal benefits. My wife, who did not work outside the home, is 3 years younger than me, and she will be at full retirement age in August of 2023. So a little bit less than a year from now, Chris. Mm-hmm. We are planning to take Social Security on January 1st of 2024. When I will be 9 months away from age 70. We are doing this due to a tax planning analysis. My understanding is that my wife's spousal benefit, if taken at or after her full retirement age, is capped at one half of my full retirement age benefit. So let's say my benefit at my full retirement age would be $3,000, which means her half would be $1,500. I believe that number was established when I turned 66 back in September of 2020. My question, Does that number stay fixed at 1,500, or will it get increased due to COLA adjustments? Thanks again for the great information and entertaining show. Calls himself George, and he is from the fine state of Kentucky.
Nice. Excellent question. Before I answer what he posed as a question, I'm going to throw one little comment out. He mentioned due to some tax analysis, it showed he should claim his Social Security 9 months before turning age 70. I don't know the analysis he did, doesn't give us any detail, but whenever somebody says it's due to tax reasons, I'm always careful, or at least I'm worried that they're looking at maybe an individual year tax issue and making a decision that's going to last the rest of their lives. So in this case, his benefit being the largest of the benefits, because his wife doesn't have her own benefit, is going to be the benefit that is going to be around until the second of them passes away. So hopefully that's for a very, very long time, maybe, 25, 30 years or more into the future. So just be careful making a decision that's going to permanently reduce that benefit by 6%. He's giving up 6% of delayed retirement credits that would otherwise be added to his monthly benefit for as long as either he or his wife lives in exchange for whatever came out of this tax analysis. So just make sure before you pull the trigger, that's actually what you want to do. And you've taken in a longer term perspective into your decision-making when claiming Social Security, because that one decision lasts for the rest of your life. And in this case, either of your lives. So to his question, does the spousal benefit, which is half of his PIA, which the PIA primary insurance amount is the one way of thinking of it is that is your retirement benefit at your full retirement age. So when he talked about his full retirement age being 66, that all aligns and that makes sense. That's true, but your PIA over time, they adjust into what I've come to start calling an adjusted PIA. Because every year, whether you're claiming or not, every year since you turned 62, they are adjusting your PIA for cost of living adjustments. So those cost of living adjustments are going to apply to your benefit, even though you haven't claimed them yet. You're going to get credit for all of those that have happened since you turned 62, all the way up until the point where you in the year you're turning 70, when you turn it on, you haven't missed any of those. Those are going to be applied to your benefit. Same thing for your wife's spousal benefit. Your wife's spousal benefit has been receiving credits for in the background and will continue after she claims to receive cost of living adjustments moving forward. So it doesn't have any arbitrary cap on it. It's capped at 50% of your PIA, but your PIA technically, which is true, that is technically true, but your PIA is evolving into this adjusted PIA that they're applying these cost of living adjustments to on and on in the background. So I'm delivering him good news. It isn't going to be, in his example, capped at 1,500 forever. It's actually been growing since 2020 when you kind of identified it as 1,500. All the cost of living adjustments since then are being applied to it in the background, will be credited to her when she claims, and any future cost of living adjustments she'll receive as well.
Was that my cue?
That's it. Yeah. The sudden silence. That's your...
I need
some kind of code word, and that's the way it is, or something like that at the end.
Well, borrow from Paul Harvey, and now you know the rest of the story.
I need my own, though.
You need your own?
Or maybe I just say Jim?
Well, it's as pithy as the name of our game show.
Sure.
Huh?
Yeah.
You wait, folks. You're laughing. Wait till NBC picks this up on their 7 o'clock primetime show to replace Wheel of Fortune. Yeah. It's going to be.
Yeah, I think Pat Sajak is about ready to retire. So if that goes away, excuse me.
There's an opening.
They can change it for. Yeah.
Huh? Wait till you see the new format of. Huh?
I can't wait.
It's killer. Okay. It's killer.
Okay.
All right. Okay. We now go in, excuse me, folks.
Uh-oh, you're getting my cough.
Yeah, well, maybe it's COVID. I hope not.
Well, I didn't have COVID.
Okay. Say what?
I didn't have COVID. I just had a cough. I'm just hoping you don't get it.
Yeah. Well, no, I haven't been in the office. Well, I was on Tuesday, but I haven't been in since then. Okay. So as we normally do, we're now going to get to the quote unquote new question of the week. And this came in on Sunday from an Oregonian. We're going to call him George, even though he gave his real name. And it has to do, Chris, with our 60-day rollover strategy.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. That's why I made it the new question of the week, because it ties into last week's show. Mm-hmm. I thought there would have been more questions on that strategy, but there's not, and that's fine. A lot of our listeners are quite intelligent. They might have picked up on everything right away. But this gentleman asked a couple of good questions. He begins, "Dear gentlemen, fascinating discussion on the year-end 60-day IRA rollover strategy. But I have two questions. Mm-hmm. First one, if part of the distribution is redeposited back into the same IRA, will the custodian issue a revised 1099 showing the net distribution?" Mm-hmm. I'll pause there. The question continues, but I'll pause there. Easily, folks and listener, no, absolutely, positively not.
Right.
The 1099 is issued when money comes out of the IRA. There is no revised 1099 because the custodian sees money coming into the IRA.
Yeah.
They don't know where that money came from, Chris.
Right.
Is that a contribution? Is it another rollover?
Yeah.
What's this money from?
Yeah, there's no tying that together to net it out.
Nope. They're not keeping track of that. They will issue a 5498 the following May, which essentially is the copy you get, because the 5498 goes to the IRS mainly, and they're telling the IRS, hey, this person put money into their IRA, and here's how much they put in, and here's the value of their IRA. And it also now has to report if there's any difficult to value assets or non-traditional assets in the IRA, so the IRS can kind of flag that in their system and keep an eye on it. They're getting a little leery of these non-traditional assets inside IRAs. Mm-hmm. So that's going to be the 5498. So he continues, if the custodian doesn't, or I suppose if the funds go back into a different IRA, I assume there is a procedure for us to show the reduced distribution on a 2022 tax return. He said, maybe this is a Bob question. It would be a good Bob question, but Bob's not here, so we will answer it. You are absolutely correct. So anybody doing a 60-day rollover, whether it's as an outright distribution or under the strategy we're chatting about it, or at least we chatted about it last week, and that strategy is within the 60-day period, you put that outstanding rollover into a Roth IRA, or at least a portion of the outstanding rollover into a Roth, in order to maximize your tax bracket. And then the rest may go back into a traditional IRA or stay out as a distribution to you, whatever the case may be. It is crucially important you give that bit of information to your tax preparer. They will get a 1099 for the gross distribution,
right,
and they're only going to think, Chris, oh, this guy took $100,000 out.
Right.
Wow, that's a big distribution. And if you ended up putting 75% of it back into an IRA, there's no corresponding tax document. So what do you do? He or she, whoever your tax preparer is, or you, if you're a do-it-yourselfer, which most of you are, you're going to account for that on your 1040 form. Now, I'm not Bob, and I don't do taxes, so I'm not sure where on the form you account for it, what box, but you do account for it to indicate that that money was put back into a IRA or into a Roth IRA.
Within the 60 days.
Mm-hmm. Right, within the 60 days. What I will share with you and everybody, and because I don't think we talked about this on the last show, Chris, is be prepared. About 2 to 3 years after you do this, to getting a letter audit. The letter is going to come in from the IRS that has already tried, convicted, and sentenced you. They are going to say, we have a 1099. It shows, and hypothetically, folks, let's say you took $100,000 out. we have a 1099 that shows 100,000 distribution. But on your taxes, we see you only indicated
25 in your example. Yeah,
25,000 of that went into a Roth and you paid taxes on it. 75,000 you didn't pay taxes on it. Because they don't know you put that other 75 back into the IRA. Remember, the strategy, folks, is purposely taking out way more than you need to overfill your tax bracket so you can figure out the exact amount you should convert to maximize your taxes that year. The cup of flour and the butter knife scraping across the top of it.
Probably the IRS optimize is probably the better word than maximize your taxes.
Okay. Optimize, much better word. Yeah. What the IRS doesn't know, all that flour that's falling off as you scrape the butter knife across the top of your cup, they don't know that's going back into the bag of flour.
Right.
So they're going to want to tax it. So you will get a letter audit. We have seen this repeatedly with clients of ours who do it. We warn them ahead of time. Don't freak out. Even though the letter is going to say they don't believe you, you owe taxes, you owe a penalty, here's what you owe us and send it by this day. Don't freak out as you read that. Your heart's going to stop fluttering. You're going to think you have AFib. If you continue in the letter audit, there's a little section where you can check a box and say, I dispute this. And then all's what you have to do is attach documented proof. And what you would do, perhaps attach the 5498 showing that the money went back into another IRA, or what we often do, statements. We show them dated statements that clearly show the money was redeposited, and we included a cover letter for the client indicating that, that we took that money and we put it back in an IRA, included for your documented proof is 5498 or a copy of the statement. And that's it. You never hear from them again. So just be aware of that. And the reason that happens, there's really no organized way of letting the IRS know beyond the 5498 that you put that money back in. And I just don't think, Chris, their system is as astute at matching.
There'll have to be a fundamental change with the way they track inflows and outflows from IRAs for this ever to net out. It's right now it's going to be totally reliant upon your proof of paperwork.
And the cynic in me says they do it this way as well, folks, because they figure a certain amount of you, it's going to be so scared. You're just going to fire that check off to them and then get all ticked off, especially if you did the taxes yourself or whatever and say, oh, I got bad advice or whatever the case may be. And maybe that's the cynic in me that they try, convict, and sentence you in that letter audit. But do be prepared for that. Okay, his second question. Can the same strategy be used? And you can answer this one, Chris, because it made me smile on this, but you can give him the bad news. Can the same strategy you described be used to reduce the year-end balance of an IRA in order to reduce the following year's required minimum distribution?
Wouldn't that be a lovely strategy? But,
he says, let's say, for example, there's a 73-year-old and they take a 60-day rollover distribution of, say, $200,000 in December of 2022. His 2023 required minimum distribution would be based on a much lower balance. Then in January of 2023, they simply redeposit the $200,000 back into the IRA, thereby reducing their RMD. I like the strategy, but I'm guessing the IRS is on to this potential loophole.
Yeah. Now, I don't know if someone tried that and they discovered it and then wrote the rule, changed the rule, or if they anticipated. I think this strategy was so obvious once they allowed 60-day rollovers that it was written in preemptively. But the rule is when you're determining the year-end balance for determination of RMDs, you must include the value of any outstanding rollovers. That's how they prevent that strategy from working.
Exactly.
It's valid. That would be a complete loophole if you could mysteriously reduce your balance just for the day that you need to measure it for determination of RMDs. Everybody would, you know, distribute their entire IRA on December 29th and then put it back in on January 2nd and no RMDs magically. Sorry, bad news. That's creative thinking, but there's specific rules in place that blow that out of the water.
Right. As Chris said, it's actually written right into the IRC by Congress. Right. Congress was on to this. As Ed Slott told us, we used to talk about this a lot on the show years ago, folks. It always was part of the rule. It wasn't a loophole that they had to go back and change. Congress was on to this from day one. And we used to sometimes say, you determine your required minimum distribution by looking at your December 31st previous year-end balance and add back to it any outstanding rollovers and any recharacterizations. Remember when you could, we're doing this whole strategy because you cannot undo a Roth conversion. You cannot recharacterize it. When Roth IRAs came out in 98, they changed that rule and added outstanding recharacterizations because they used to give you folks until October 15th of the following year to redo a conversion. What they didn't want was somebody converting their IRA in December and then recharacterizing it later and always showing a very minimal, if any, 1231 year-end balance. People try it all the time. Even to this day, people try it. But the IRS eventually catches them and nails them. So two good questions. Unfortunately, the second one, his little strategy there, nah, someone else thought of that. Congress thought of it and killed it from the get-go.
Yep.
All righty. Let's get to questions. So Bob is coming on the show next Tuesday. So as I was researching questions for Bob, I found a slew. If three questions can be considered a slew, I found a slew of questions on health savings accounts.
Oh.
All from August of 2021.
We must have done a show on it.
We must have done a show on HSAs in August of 2021, which elicited these questions. They were in a little pile that I had marked for questions for Bob. You know how I print and just leave them there.
Yeah.
So anyways, I thought, hey, we might as well do this. No sense waiting for Bob to come back. So we're going to have a couple of HSA questions right now, Chris.
Okay.
HSA question one came from, well, we're going to call him George, but he does not list his state. Okay. He says, does everyone in the family have to be covered by the high deductible healthcare plan in order to contribute the family maximum? I am a single father with a 20-year-old dependent son who is attending university. I am covered under a high deductible healthcare plan, but my son is not. Can I contribute the family maximum to my HSA, or can I only contribute the individual maximum limit? Thank you.
It's a good question, but a very clear answer.
It is. So, well, actually, it's not overly clear. So let's look at the one thing he didn't. There's two rather important pieces of information that I want to make clear in his email that are missing.
True.
The first thing, folks, he says, I am covered under a high deductible health care plan. So am I, folks. I have an $8,000 deductible on my high deductible health care plan, but I did not put any money in my HSA this year, nor did I put any in last year. And most likely I won't put any in next year because I don't think I'm going to change my plan. Do you know why I can't do that, Chris?
Because your high deductible healthcare plan doesn't qualify. There's another word for it.
I use the word qualify. It's not HSA eligible.
Yeah, there you go. Eligible is what I meant. Yeah, it's not HSA
eligible.
It's okay. It doesn't meet the there's specific criteria for a high deductible plan. It has to be high deductible, but it has to meet specific criteria to be HSA eligible.
Exactly. And my plan doesn't have that. You might be saying, what the hell do you have that plan for, Jim? because I have AFib and I know I have to have these procedures. And this policy gives me much better coverage when I max out my deductible. So I purposefully don't have an HSA eligible plan. I have a high deductible plan. It's not HSA eligible. So the first thing, listener, and I know you sent this over a year ago, but the first thing to anybody who is in a similar situation, just because you have a high deductible healthcare plan does not mean you can put money into an HSA account. Make sure it is HSA eligible. The healthcare plans usually say right in the name or the description at note. It definitely is in the description, but sometimes you'll see it in the name, HSA eligible. So that's the first thing I picked up on. The second thing, listener, you didn't tell me what kind of plan you have. You just said you had a high deductible healthcare plan and you had a 20-year-old dependent son and he's not on that plan.
Right.
Okay. But what kind of plan do you have? The deduction or the contribution limits of the HSA are tied to the type of plan you have. If you have a family plan, but you're the only family member participating in that plan, it doesn't matter.
Right.
You have a family plan, you can contribute the family maximum.
Yep.
So if he has a HSA eligible family plan, Chris, he can put the full amount in. Mm-hmm. If he has a non-HSA eligible high deductible plan, he can't put anything in. Or if he only has a single plan, then he can only put the single amount in. So that's the answer. I'm hoping it makes sense. I make that clear.
Yeah. So
enough?
There's, yeah. And that's what I meant, but there's clear rules on this. And it's the triggering event is, you mentioned the first one, it's got to be an HSA eligible plan. And then second, is it a self only or individual plan, or is it a family plan? Doesn't matter who's actually covered by it. It's what is the designation of the plan. And it's that designation that sets the limit that can be contributed into the HSA. So he kind of implies that he's the only one on the high deductible plan. His son isn't. So he's got an individual plan, but it doesn't come out and say that. It is possible. Maybe he didn't include his spouse or other people that might be on a family plan with him. Or like you mentioned, he's paying for a family plan, but he's the only one signed up for it, which would be kind of strange because it'd be a lot more expensive than an individual plan if you're not going to cover other people on it. Seems silly. But if he happens to be, because maybe temporarily he's the only one on it and other people are going to join him or something, he technically could do the family maximum as long as it's a family style high deductible health plan that is HSA eligible.
Perfect. Okay. We've got two more HSA plans, questions. Mm-hmm. But before we get to that, I've got to pause just because I am laughing over here like crazy. And I got to share that with everybody. And it's December. We're going to have fun in December. As you know, right now, the World Cup is going on. And yeah, to me, soccer is one of the most boring sports to sit there and watch. Mm-hmm. I don't understand it. They spend 90 minutes, an hour, an hour and a half, 2 hours, who knows how long, running up and down, kicking a ball and never scoring a damn goal. I don't get it. But Rachel, the woman I'm dating, is from Brazil. Apparently, Brazil has a good hockey team. Soccer team. Yeah. May have a good hockey team, too. I don't know. And she is wicked into soccer. Mm-hmm. And I just don't get it. So she asked me, they're playing now. I don't even know if the game is over yet or not. So I did have it on before I started recording, but I muted it and it's in the other room. I just got an email from her a few minutes ago, Chris, and she types, goal! They shout goal. That's the other thing.
Yeah.
They shout goal. When she was here on Thanksgiving, they were playing and she would, I'm trying to cook elk stew and turkey and I hear all of a sudden come from the living room, goal! And she's just screaming goal for like 5 minutes. She sends me this text, go! And I swear to you, the timestamp about 20 seconds later comes in. Oh no, it was Croatia who made the goal.
Oh no. That's not good.
She got all excited that there was a goal and she didn't realize it was Croatia who scored it, not Brazil. That's how boring the damn game is. You can't even tell who scored.
You get so excited that someone scored.
Finally, after 2 hours, someone scored. Let's yell goal. And then they realize, oh, crap, it's the other team. Yeah. And then she wrote, Porquet with a bunch of question marks. I have no idea what porquet means. Now I got to look at, unless do you speak Portuguese? What does porquet mean?
Why?
Why?
Yeah, like why?
Because they're the better team, I guess. They scored the goal.
Croatia is not better than Brazil. They're tied 1-1 right now as we record this. I don't know how that.
Oh, you look.
By the time people listen to this, the score will be, we'll know who won, but that would be beyond shocking if Croatia beats Brazil in the World Cup. I'm not a big fan. My kids, because they played soccer, are fans, so I kind of hear about it as they're watching it and talking about it. But yeah, they're 1-1 right now, so that's probably shocking to a Brazilian soccer fan.
Well, she should have sent me another text with goal, because now that would have been the appropriate one. It's just so funny that she sends, oh no, Croatia scored the goal. All right. Anyways, that's soccer for you, folks.
Oh, it's the end of extra time. Oh, they're in overtime and they're in a kickoff is why. That's why things are so crazy. Yeah, she's going to send you some really emotional texts here shortly.
Oh, why? Did Croatia win again?
No, they're in the middle of, they are doing penalty kicks, I think a shootout. They're doing penalty shootouts.
So, oh, they keep kicking until someone scores?
Until one scores and the other one doesn't, and that they're going to win, whoever that is.
Oh, so they can't tie in soccer. It's just someone eventually
has to
kick.
Once you get to this level, this in the World Cup, they don't allow ties. Someone has to win.
Oh.
So they're at that point now, so. Yeah, gotcha. Yeah, she's gonna be a little tough to deal with if Brazil loses. Just warning you.
Now, if Brazil loses, do they have to go home?
Yes.
Oh,
they're in the win to move on phase.
Win or go home.
Yep.
All right. Okay. Well, I wish her luck. I have no idea what's going on. Next HSA question. Came from a Pennsylvanian, gave his full name, but we're, as always, going to call him George. He said, I would like to leave my HSA account upon my death to my donor-advised fund. Is this possible, or do I have to name an actual person as beneficiary of my HSA? This one, Chris, when it came in, I thought to myself, I don't see any reason why this guy can't do it. You can leave an IRA to a donor advised fund. You can leave a 401k. You can leave an annuity. You can leave a life insurance policy. Why can't you leave an HSA? So my answer to him was, yes, I believe you can. So I got a hold of the Ed Slot Group. There's one of his consultants is their HSA go-to person. And her email back to me was pretty much the same thing. She says, Jim, I don't see anything preventing it, but I don't see anything explicitly saying you can. Her thought is the same as mine, Chris. Yes, you can do that. But what I would suggest is you get a hold of your HSA, get a hold of the custodian, call them up, ask to speak to someone besides the person answering the phone. There's definitely going to be, they call it the advanced markets is usually what they call it. But there's going to be a person there who will know HSAs inside and out. But also, they may have already received money from HSA accounts. Excuse me, call up the donor advised fund people. And they may have already received, Chris, money from HSAs. And they know the answer is yes right off the bat. Or maybe there is a bizarre rule and they can't accept money from an HSA. They would know it. Don't call the HSA custodian. They're probably going to be, I don't know. But if you call the donor advised fund custodian, I really do feel someone there can answer that question. But my gut and the Ed Slot person, her name is Sarah, her thoughts, we can't see any reason why you can't. And there's nothing explicitly saying that we know of you can't. Right. We're not experts in HSAs, but that's my thoughts. Do you have any?
I've not dedicated my life to reading everything there is to know about HSAs, but I have read a fair amount. I've never run across anything that says yes or no. So I think my information is consistent with what you said. There seems to be no reason you couldn't do it, but I've never had experience with someone doing it or read that it's specifically allowed. So, but I think going to the donor advised fund is probably great because they'll they probably know the answer right off the bat, because they'll people be, you know, many people they've worked with and have probably tried to do that, and they've discovered the answer already. So,
okay, perfect. While you were chatting, I turned around in my seat and looked at my big screen TV.
Yeah.
And I'm going to, I think, have a very sad girlfriend tonight.
Yeah, it's not looking
the team
good.
In yellow, which is Brazil, they showed crying. And then the team in white jumping up and down. I don't know how, but I think Croatia beat Brazil. Is that a safe assumption?
The thing I'm looking at doesn't show. Oh, yeah. That is true, because in the penalty period, Croatia scored 4 and Brazil only scored 2. So,
you don't just kick once and the first to score, like football, first
not.
To score
no.
wins?
And no, because it leaves too much up to luck, I think. I'm not a soccer expert. I'm just looking at the way they scored it. I'm not on the television. I'm on my computer. But I bet there's a lot of crying. This is shocking.
Wow. Shocking. Okay.
So.
All right. Yeah. Well, we're going out.
Don't check your phone for a little bit. But
we're going out to dinner tonight. I wonder if she would be upset if I like wore white and red.
Well, if you take her to a Croatian restaurant and see how it goes.
Yeah. Get this beautiful restaurant in Boulder.
Yeah. Have you ever had Croatian food?
I don't know. If she
if
has.
You want to make her feel better, maybe,
Chris,
maybe Brazilian.
You're talking to the. You're talking to the guy who once said to this woman, wow, your hands look as old and wrinkly as my hands do. So I'm on thin ice with this woman to begin with.
Okay, so you better be booking something at the best Brazilian steakhouse you can find.
Exactly. Even joking with her that we should get Croatian food.
It's probably too much, yeah.
It's probably not going to go over too. Oh, wait, she just texted me.
Yeah.
We lost, crying, sad face.
Yeah. Yeah. And that little emoticon isn't possibly doing justice to capturing her feelings right now.
Probably. She is feeling right now. I guarantee you how I felt in February of 2008 when the New York Giants ruined the New England Patriots' perfect 2007 season and won the Super Bowl in February of 2008.
Yeah, this would be a
God, I was
thing.
Devastated.
Yeah, yeah. And you probably didn't eat New York-style pizza for a year and, you know.
Well, the only two things from New York I do eat are their bagels and pizza, because they're phenomenal. Other than that, I want nothing to do with New York. But their pizza, this Chicago pizza, thick crust crap, blah.
It's a different food, in my opinion. It's not even the same food.
You got to have New York.
Yeah. Oh, I agree. I prefer it, but I appreciate a good Chicago style, but I don't call it pizza. It's more like a casserole.
A carbohydrate casserole.
Yeah, well.
But New York pizza, phenomenal. Mm-hmm. And the bagels, I've said this before and I'll say it again, Colorado bagel, because of our elevation, I'm not just blaming the bagel makers in Colorado. They can't boil right, and they are disgusting. But New York bagels, phenomenal.
Yeah.
Okay. Next HSA question came from a listener in. No idea. But he does give his real name, but we're going to call him George. Mm-hmm. He says, I have an HSA question. And remember, folks, all of these came in back in August, and this one came in September of 2021. So he must have done HSA shows back then. Jim and Chris, my wife and I are American, and we're working overseas. We have a Cigna high-deductible healthcare plan, and it is also a worldwide plan. Can we contribute to an HSA while we are still living overseas if we meet all the HSA criteria as noted in the IRS Regulation Code, Section 223? Where does it say? In Section 223, indicating Americans working overbroad could... Wait a minute. I did not see anything in Section 223. I apologize, folks. Having a hard time reading today. I did not see anything in Section 223 of the tax code indicating Americans working abroad could not contribute to an HSA as long as they meet the criteria noted in Section 223. Do you think we can contribute to an HSA? What are your thoughts? My thoughts were exactly what he said. Mm-hmm. He never indicated if his HSA is, I mean, high deductible healthcare plan is HSA eligible, but he said if he meets all the criteria, and that's part of the criteria. So I just assume he has an HSA appropriate high deductible healthcare plan. But once again, I fired this off to Sarah and I said, hey, Sarah, my thoughts, he can do it. She wrote back. She said, Jim, I too see nothing that says you can't. And she doesn't see why he couldn't contribute the money to the HSA. We're not experts on this, but my gut tells me, yes, he can. Now, he sent this over a year ago. Hopefully, mm-hmm. he decided to contribute. But we haven't seen it. We, being Sarah and I, don't see anything in that section preventing it. If anybody knows otherwise, please share it with us, and we will announce it on the podcast, of course.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've, again, never seen, read anything that would disallow it just because you happen to be physically out of the country. As long as you meet all the criteria, there's no other mention in the rules. So I think they're probably good to go. I'd love to hear if there's some nuance or footnote or special call out somewhere that would block them from doing it. But I think they're good to go.
Okay. Alrighty. This question came in October of 2021. You can see I found a 2021 pile of emails.
Clearly. Yeah.
And he thought we might want to do a EDU show on this, but I'm not going to because it's not something we normally do. But I thought his question was pretty good and we would chat about it. He says, hi, Jim and Chris. I am 62 and recently retired. So he's obviously going to be 63 now and been retired for a year. I'm a big fan of your show and longtime listener. Hopefully he kept listening, even though we didn't get to his question until now. I recommend this following question as an EDU show, but we're going to answer it as just a Q&A. He said, here are my questions. What is a bond ladder? When and why would anyone ever want to use it? And what are the mechanics of setting it up? Fairly easy, straightforward, minimalist question. So it's the question I would have written. I mean, perfect.
Sure.
So I thought we would chat a little bit, folks, about bond ladders because we're starting to get interest even with some of the people we work with because of higher interest rates on if they should construct either a bond ladder or our preference, a CD ladder for generating income or even a MYGA, multi-year guaranteed annuity ladder. It's the ladder part that I think is confusing him and maybe confusing some people. So what is a bond ladder? It's just an analogy. It's a good visualization. You purchase a bond to generate income. And up until this year, the income that bonds had been paying for goodness, the last 5-6 years has been very, very minimal, not much interest. And that was done purposefully by the Federal Reserve. They lowered interest rates to the point where they made owning safe assets not worth it. Why did they do that? They wanted to force people into risk-based assets and force the price of risk-based assets up, such as real estate, equities, things of that nature. And by forcing them up, they create this concept called the wealth effect. As people feel wealthy because their risk-based assets are rising, they go out and spend more money, and that can help support economies. So that's a very eighth grade level, 30,000 foot view of what the Fed was trying to do. But what it made was owning safe assets, or quote unquote, relatively safe assets, because we know this year bonds are not principally safe at all times. But bond ladders really fell out of favor, Chris, because the interest rates were just too low. But now there's interest again in them. And what the ladder does is this. Let's just say you bought a bond that's going to pay you interest for 3 years, and then it's going to pay you back all your money. It, quote unquote, matures in 3 years. Now, when you're dealing with bonds, you have to deal with callable bonds. You might have to deal with the volatility of the price of bonds in between the time you buy it and sell it. So there's a lot of moving parts here. And if you're buying bonds yourself, especially in the secondary market and not at new issue, you're buying bonds yourself in the secondary market, you best know what you're doing because you're going to get into the bid-ask spread. You're going to get in.
Yeah. Even at issue, you need to know what you're doing. You need to fully, any investment in a bond would be considered one. You need to fully understand all the mechanics and the risks involved to decide if it's something that fits properly with your situation. So we're giving you kind of a familiarization talk here, not a everything you could possibly need to know about bonds in order to rush out and buy one. That is not what this is.
Exactly. And to carry on with purchase, because he wants to know what it is and how you would set it up. Keep in mind, listeners, companies and governments aren't necessarily in business to sell very small bonds. Now, the federal government will to residents. They will allow you to buy I bonds and double E. No, I don't even think double E bonds are around anymore. But
treasuries,
definitely treasuries. Mm-hmm. Definitely I bonds, TIPS. You can get them at treasurydirect.gov. The name says it all. You deal directly with the treasury and you can buy bonds, very small denomination bonds from the government themselves. But you don't see companies and municipalities doing that. They are going to sell hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars of bonds to brokers who will then take those and begin slicing them into smaller tranches. And they may take those and give them to a brokerage house who then slice those into smaller tranches and give them to their brokers to sell. And each slice of those tranches, folks, someone is keeping some of the interest. It's called yield spread. So when you're buying bonds in the secondary market, recognize that if you're going to run out waving your $20,000 or $30,000 you want to put in a bond, that bond has been diced and sliced several times. So you fall victim to the yield spread. In other words, someone else is getting money off of this repeatedly throughout the life of the bond. And you have to deal with the bid-ask spread. How much do you have to pay to get it? And what is that bond worth if you had to sell it? So it's a very involved process. It's one of the reasons we like doing this or would encourage you to think of doing this with CDs, which operate significantly differently. But nonetheless, the concept is this. You buy a bond that matures in 3 years, another one that matures in, say, 5 years, 6 years, 7 years, 8 years, or you can do it in wider spreads, bond that matures in 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, something like that. The longer it takes the bond to mature, generally speaking, the more interest you will get. Now, that's not holding true right now on the date I'm recording this. Long-term rates on many CDs are lower than short-term rates. We're starting to get an inverted yield curve. See how confusing this can get, Chris? So you have to really be careful sometimes going out on the bond ladder that you are going to be rewarded for tying your money up for a longer period of time. But people will set up bond ladders so they want liquidity. People will do this for liquidity, folks. They want some liquidity. They want the protection. They don't want to lock their money up in a bond for a long period of time because if they have to sell that bond for liquidity, they might have to sell it at a lower price than they would get if they just held the bond to maturity when it has to pay out at par value. So assuming the company doesn't go out of business during that time frame, if you hold a bond to maturity, you will get the par value of that bond. Unless you bought a premium bond, then you might get less. Or if you bought a discount bond, you might get more. Now we're getting really deep into the weeds. And I'm doing that on purpose to get most people to understand, even though it sounds simple, it's not an easy thing to do. You really need to know what you're doing. There's brokers who specialize in this, and there's exchange-traded funds, and there's mutual funds that also specialize in this. Be very careful if you try to do it on your own. But nonetheless, the theory is, because he asked, when would someone want to use it and why? You want to use it to generate income. You don't necessarily want to spend your principal, but you want access to that principal on a regular basis in case something comes up that you don't know of. So if a bond, if you bought just one 20-year bond, there's a lot of crap that could happen in 20 years, can it not, Chris?
Yeah, and all the while you're just getting interest payments along that time period and you're not getting your principal back. So having this series of shorter term rungs on the ladder, if you will, to get back to the laddering, you can get kind of a cash influx each time a new one of these bonds matures and you get that principal payment back.
Right. And I do have to get running because I have a seminar coming up. But what I wanted to get to, folks, is he's asking when and why would you use one? You generally use it when you're looking to get income, but you want access to liquidity, but you also want the benefits of owning longer term bonds because they normally pay higher interest rates, even though we have an inverted yield curve or close to an inverted yield curve right now. So that's why you would buy, rather than one 20-year bond, you would buy maybe a 5, 10, 15, 20, or even I've seen it done yearly, a 3-year, 4-year, 5-year, 6-year, 7-year bond, and every year money is coming back to you. If you don't need that money, you go out to the longest term of your ladder. You should know ahead of time the term you're going to make. 5-year term, 10-year term, 15, 20, whatever the term is. Let's just say you have a 10-year ladder. That means, and you do it yearly. That means every year a bond is scheduled to mature. If you don't need that money, you simply go out and buy a new 10-year bond with it. Now, it does expose you to interest rate risk because interest rates could be higher or lower, but that's just the nature of the beast. You go out and buy another 10-year bond. The following year, you have another bond maturing if you need the liquidity. In the meantime, you're getting a steady stream of interest payments coming in, and you ostensibly live on the interest. That's what a bond ladder is. Mm-hmm. I'm not a huge fan of them, and they're not nearly as easy to set up and monitor as it sounds, but that's what a bond ladder is.
Perfect. Okay, well, you need to get running so I can close things out if you need to bail out.
But, I am going to bail out and go on to my online seminar, but thanks, people. Hopefully everybody found today interesting. If you want to stay on and answer some Social Security questions, I can send you some, but if you want to wrap up, you can wrap up.
We've hit an hour, so I think we've fulfilled our obligation to podcasting world. So,
excellent.
Have a good weekend. Have a good seminar. I'll talk to you later. Everyone else, if you want to send in your questions for future shows, best way to do that is to just email Jim directly. Just go to just email his email, jim@jimhelps.com. You could also go to our website, jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. There's a contact form on there you can submit through, but I think you increase your chances it'll come to Jim's attention with a direct email to him in the subject line, put a question for the podcast. I think that's where he's getting most of these kind of new question of the weeks that he pulls out. So increase your chances of getting a quick turnaround on your question if you do it that way. So we really appreciate everybody listening and sending in questions. Both of those things have to happen for the podcast to continue. So thanks a lot, everybody. Hope your December is going well, as I mentioned before. And next week, we'll see how Bob does on the EDU show as we do a focused tax Q&A for an EDU show. I'll have Bob back on with some tax questions. And apparently, Bob's going to play the new game, huh? And we'll see how that goes. So take care. We'll be back with you next week.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Saulnier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Solnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.